Are you ready to become a better version of yourself, to become a leader in your personal and professional life? Then welcome to the CJ Evolution Podcast, where we put a twist on traditional criminal justice professions and provide you with the tools you need to set yourself up for success in your career and for the future. Now, welcome your host, the CJ Evolutionist himself, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Episode 258 of CJ Evolution. That's Criminal Justice Evolution. Patrick here. I'm the host and creator of this great and growing show, growing because of you, the listener and supporter. If you would just take a moment and rate and review my podcast, I sure would appreciate it. You can see a link to iTunes on the cjevolution.com website. And again, I sure would appreciate that review. Special thanks to all those brave men and women working in the criminal justice field. Whatever you were doing, thank you so much for doing a fantastic job, putting it all on the line every day and night. You got much support. Don't ever forget that. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. If you're a longtime listener, again, welcome back. Special thanks to Four Sigmatic, an amazing coffee company I'm so blessed to be partnered with. You're going to love their products. For all of you working in the criminal justice field or whatever you're doing, I know you drink coffee, at least the majority of you do, and you will not be disappointed with the products from Four Sigmatic. And best of all, you're going to get 15% off using the promo code CJEVO. You know, folks, my next guest you're going to love. I had the honor of meeting this gentleman down in Miami recently at the beginning of December. Grab a notepad, grab a pen, and take some notes. He is truly an inspirational speaker. I should forewarn you, though, I don't know what went on with the audio. It's a little echoey at certain points, and I apologize, but you're going to love the content. Enjoy. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. I am very excited to have Jay Dobbins on the show. I had the honor and pleasure of meeting Jay down at the Conclave of Warriors at the beginning of December. Jay was he's a former federal agent for 27 years. He retired in 2014. He is perhaps best known for his landmark effort against the notorious Hells Angels. He was the first ever lawman to defeat the gang's multi-layered security measures, getting inside to become a member of their legendary Skull Valley Charter. Jay, sir, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me and having me chat again, and thank you to your audience for tuning in and listening to what we have to say.
Well, I appreciate it, Jay. I know you're a very busy man, and I appreciate you being here. The audience does too. I mean, did I give you due justice with that intro, sir? Is there anything you want to add to that?
No, your check is in the mail, and you read it exactly as I dictated it to you. So I was happy with it, and I love that we're communicating to Copland out there, because those are our brothers and sisters.
Absolutely. Yeah. And how did you get into law enforcement, Jay? And I had the honor of seeing you speak in Conclave, but I know probably some people out there listening probably don't know how you got into law enforcement. How did your life take a turn into the career?
You know, I got involved in law enforcement almost by default. I was a failed professional football player. Growing up, that was my goal. My goal was to play football and to make a living doing it. I had a very nice, productive college football career, and that success in college brainwashed me into believing that I was going to make a living doing it. And when it came down to it, I was a tough kid. I was a tough football player, and I realized the hard way that if you want to play professionally, it takes more than toughness. Mm-hmm. It takes talent. And my talents and my skills were not what they needed to be, mm-hmm. to be quite honest, to play at that level. I know a lot of people, I'm sure, you know, everybody does out there, who maybe overestimated what they were as an athlete. Mm-hmm. I think I did that, and found out the hard way that those young men, some, you know, ultimately adult men, mm-hmm. that do that for a living are absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. They're freak shows. I wasn't. I was a grinder. And so when that came to an end, I had to figure out what I was going to do. My dreams had crashed. my plans for my life, my goals had crashed. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I knew a couple things. I knew that I wanted to have a job, that when my alarm clock went off in the morning and I put my feet on the ground, I was doing something on someone else's behalf, that I was serving. And really all I had ever been good at, when I looked at myself very honestly and very clearly, all I'd ever really been good at was standing up to bullies. Mm-hmm. So as things came about and I was trying to sort out my life, and I know we had this conversation, the television show Miami Vice was very popular.
Yeah.
And I was intrigued by Sonny Crockett, you know, driving a Lamborghini around South Beach and meeting with drug kingpins and wearing a Hugo Boss suit and all the glamour and sexiness of what the entertainment industry had led me to believe a career in law enforcement would be. I wanted to take a crack at undercover work. That's how I wanted to put my dent in the universe. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, very quickly, I found out that Hollywood and Hollywood's interpretation of what we do for a living is counterfeit. It's a hoax. It's nothing like our world is portrayed to the public. Mm-hmm. But even finding that out and finding it out the hard way, I loved it. I considered it an honor and a privilege to carry a badge and a gun and to be asked to protect and defend and take care of the communities that I worked in.
And you worked for the ATF. How many years, sir?
I did. I was an ATF agent for 27 years, from 1987 to 2014.
And the majority of work you did was undercover, right, Jay?
It was. That was my love. It was my passion. I was successful at it. Over the course of my career, I was involved in well over 500 undercover operations. And that, you know, like I think all of us in the business are trying to find what we do well, what we enjoy, what we can be great at. And that was just – it was my love. I loved my job every day. Every morning I got up, I was excited to go to work. Mm-hmm.
Now, some people out there, Jay, maybe not a lot of people that are listening, because a lot of people that are listening are in criminal justice and are cops, but I know that some people out there think that officers that work undercover war or operations have to compromise certain things. And I know you've talked about this many times before. But some people, a lot of people maybe out there, think that undercover officers have to do drugs. They have to start committing crimes. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I can. From a couple aspects. The line between right and wrong, the line of morals and ethics and policy and procedure. I didn't find that line to be a thin line. I found it to be a big, fat, thick line. Mm-hmm. There are situations and events and circumstances as an undercover operator that you're going to be confronted with that you can't cross that line, because if you do, you end up ultimately becoming a witness against a suspect, a defendant. And if you're engaging and acting identical to the person that's being prosecuted, you're no more credible on the witness stand than that person is for having to defend themselves against their allegations. So mm-hmm. There were a few things very early on in my career that I had decided I would not tolerate in an undercover role. I was not going to allow someone to be murdered in my presence. I was not going to allow a woman to be raped. Mm-hmm. And I was not going to allow a kid to be beaten, abused in my presence. I always thought that if I was confronted with those situations, I would come out of role and do the very best I could to contain that situation. And then I thought, like everything else, whatever else might come my way, I'll figure it out. And then ultimately through experience and expertise and training and mentorship and all those other things that we experience on the job, I was able to avoid, like for example, the drug situation. Mm-hmm. It was routinely presented and I routinely had escapes.
Yeah. But that came through training and experience, and you knew a hell of a lot what you were doing.
Yeah, and I think that, you know what, in today's world, not every criminal out there, not every gangster, not every biker, not every drug dealer, not every gun runner, not every rapist or human trafficker or white-collar crime person is a drug addict. They're not all drug users.
Yeah.
Some of those people, in fact, are quite the opposite. Some of them get 10 hours of sleep every night and eat, you know, 5 well-balanced meals a day and go to the gym for hours a day and take care of themselves physically. To think or to feel like I'm going to have to use drugs to fit in, is a cop-out.
Yeah.
You're shortchanging your abilities as an undercover operator if you have to default to that.
Yeah. One of the stories I loved when you were telling it, you told it down in Miami, and I saw it when I was doing some more research. It was the story about how, I think it was before you got into the Hell's Angels club, you had to hit another opposing gang member, and there was this big, huge staging of this murder of this Mongol, correct?
Yes, that operation was a part of the Hell's Angels infiltration case.
Yeah.
But I had done that, or the equivalent of that, many times before, where I had been solicited by a suspect in my role as a hitman to commit a murder on their behalf. Mm-hmm. And as part of the building of that investigation and building a solid case and evidence and validating overt acts and all those things, we routinely recruited our victim to cooperate with us. And then we would, you know, dress that person up to various degrees to make them look dead.
Yeah.
And then take that fabricated murder back to our suspect to prove that we had committed the murder. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that again, those are parts of the training and technique and expertise and mentorship and lessons learned and mistakes and failures as well as successes that help develop those skills for any of us in whatever it is, whatever element of the job we do, to try to do it well.
Now, what mentors did you have throughout your career, Jay? I mean, because you were in some harrowing. I mean, your whole career was life and death. I mean, you had to have people in your life, you know this, that were pumping you up because you were surrounded by a lot of negativity, a lot of bad stuff. So who were the people that kept you going?
Well, you know, on the job as an ATF agent, I was attracted to ATF initially because of the strength of the Bureau's undercover program. Mm-hmm. ATF, in my mind, had the most dynamic undercover program in federal law enforcement, and I wanted to be a part of that. And the godfathers of that, the men and women who participated in that program and paved the road for me, were extraordinary. They were amazing. They continually did more with less. ATF is not a big agency. You know, it's a small sister agency to, you know, the big boys, to the FBI, to DEA, you know, in today's world, to Homeland Security. And so we were routinely asked to do more with less and be creative. And my mentors, the people that trained me, the people that I looked to for guidance and inspiration, were masters of that. Mm-hmm.
Do you think, I mean, I don't know if you still have your, I mean, what do you think about law enforcement today, Jay? I know you're on the federal level when you were in, but do you think law enforcement has changed overall? Well, maybe that's a broad question, but do you think it's changed since you've been in the game?
Sure. It's changed immensely. It changed while I was in the game.
Yeah.
The way the job was done and the way the job was viewed when I started in 1987 evolved even while I was on the job. Mm-hmm. To the point, like even internally, even at ATF, like for us, a watershed moment at ATF was my agency's attempt to raid the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, that David Koresh and his followers were inhabiting, and some of the despicable things that were taking place within that compound, the child abuse, the sex abuse that was taking place in there. ATF, you know, found jurisdiction through the firearms and explosives violations that were alleged. They used undercover operatives to enhance that intelligence and gain more information. But then when that broke bad, when those events took place, which resulted in, you know, the deaths of four ATF agents and another 20 chewed up and torn up by gunfire and explosives. And then following that, the standoff and then the fire and the 68 plus people that died there at that compound. Just that and like what was required from there forward with regards to like is something as simple as operational plans. And the extent and the detail that was then required in operational plans moving into the future, we weren't playing under those rules pre-Waco.
Yeah.
You know, I look at law enforcement today, and it is, man, the men and women that are out there that are doing it, man, they have my love, my admiration, my respect. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the underappreciated, going underpaid, doing the unthinkable for the ungrateful.
Do you think it's going to get better? Because I know we're at a point right now where there's a lot of anti-police sentiment out there. Do you think it's going to swing back? Because I think it always does.
I felt like it has swung back over the last couple years. But I think that as societies typically resist authority. They press back against that. At least minority elements of society, mm-hmm. Small factions of society do press back against that. When it comes down to it, the people pushing back, the people bad mouthing cops, are really a very vocal minority, a silent, quieter majority of society of the world. Does appreciate law enforcement and does understand that those men and women who put a uniform on in the morning and come to work and leave their families and know that when they kiss their kids and their wives and their husbands goodbye in the morning, they might not see them again. And they place themselves between the good and innocent people in their community and the predators. Mm-hmm. Those people are appreciated. Yeah. And I think most people do know we have to have those people out there to have a sane, civil existence.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think it is. I think there's a vast majority, and we talk about it on the show a lot. I think the vast majority of people out there support law enforcement, support their efforts. But again, I agree with you. I think it's that very vocal minority out there, group of population, that is very vocal, that it gets the media's attention. And that's what people focus on, and they kind of harp on that, and they kind of look, and they everybody, you know, law enforcement is kind of painted with a broad brush sometimes.
Well, there's definitely an effort out there to paint the profession with a very broad brush and try to cover everyone that serves in those roles under the same using the same characterizations, and you know, in the 27 years that I was involved and then another 5 years still involved in the profession from an outside position, the thousands and thousands of lawmen and women that I crossed paths with who were moral and ethical and really did want to do a good job, there may have been two or three that I personally had touched my life or my career mm-hmm. that were corrupt, that were dirty cops. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I think what society maybe doesn't understand is that there is no one out there who dislikes, disapproves, or hates a dirty cop more than good cops.
Exactly. That's a great point. Now, let's change gears a little bit, Jay, if you don't mind. When you were embedded in with the Hells Angels, and when you started making arrests and you started taking these guys down, obviously your cover was blown. Can you talk about the aftermath, what happened with that? Because there were a lot of death threats. There were a lot of threats on your life and your family's life. Can you talk about that?
Sure. When my true identity was exposed, the person that the suspects had grown loyal to and had in some cases fallen in love with, the person they believed to be Jay Davis, Jay Bird, the hitman, gun runner, debt collector, when they found out that Jay Bird was actually Jay Dobbins, undercover federal agent, man, that's hard to swallow in that world. No one wants to be humiliated. No one wants to be tricked or deceived or betrayed. The human factor in us doesn't like that. When that is done, when that is placed into the lives of people who are inherently violent and dangerous, they push back. Mm-hmm. And, I had several murder contracts on me. The Hells Angels held a murder contract on me. They'd farmed a contract on me to the Aryan Brotherhood. They'd farmed one to the MS-13. It went too far. It went into my it came to my family. Mm-hmm. There was threats to kidnap and torture my kids. There was threats out there to kidnap and videotape the gang rape of my wife. And that is a very tragic and terrible downside of what we do for a living, yeah. But nonetheless, it is reality. Mm-hmm. It is the nature of the people that we're crossing paths with and going toe to toe with. Mm-hmm.
Do you still get threats? I think somebody asked you this in Conclave. Do you still get threats, Jay?
You know, the big wave of threats that I was facing, hopefully, I keep my fingers crossed and I say prayers. Most of that is in the past. Yes, I receive threats. I don't hide. I live my life, I guess is the simplest way to say it. I don't live in fear, because if I live in fear, they've won. Yeah. They've won. To some extent, they own me if I live in fear. I do live with caution.
Sure.
I've seen firsthand what they're capable of. I know that these guys have their PhDs in violence intimidation. I've been a witness to what they're willing to do to defend their world. So I'm not blind to that, but I do my best to avoid it. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking for a problem. I don't want a problem. I do everything I can to avoid problems. Sometimes people force those problems into my life, and I'm prepared to deal with them. Yeah. But for the most part, that situation, you know, like I said, making the sign of the cross over me has been placed in the past.
One of the things that I found truly inspirational is that you picked up and you needed some time and you went overseas and you helped, I believe it was in Africa, correct?
I did. There was a very, I was at a very dark point and place in my life where I was feeling sorry for myself. I was feeling pathetic. I didn't feel like the world had treated me fairly. And I didn't feel like the things that were happening to me, I didn't feel like I had them coming. Mm-hmm. And I had a friend reach out to me and told me about a program where he along with some other people, rescues orphans in Africa, mm-hmm. And helps provide them, with food and clean drinking water. And, you know, he went on to explain that, you know, we have orphans here in the U.S. too. And although our system, has flaws, we do have an infrastructure. If a kid is orphaned, we do have the ability to put a roof over their head and give them a sandwich and give them a bottle of water and have someone care for them. These kids over there, the society just doesn't do that for a number of reasons. And so, as we talked about, I was ready to write a check. I wanted to feel good about myself. I wanted to feel like I was doing something positive for the world, and I was ready to put whatever number he wanted on that check to mm-hmm. contribute to his mission. And his response was, "Man, I don't want your money. I want you to go with me."
Yeah.
I was very reluctant to go. I didn't want to go. I did. I went. I prepared myself. I went over there, and the last place on earth that I wanted to be and the last group of people on earth that I wanted to spend time with absolutely changed my life. Mm-hmm. Those kids that I had really no interest in having a personal connection with, they saved me.
Yeah.
They have nothing. The saying, not having a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out of, they invented it there.
Yeah.
Those kids hope to someday have hope. They're so desperate. And, you know, I went into villages that some of those villages, some of the little ones there had never seen a white face before.
Wow.
And they were happy and they were loving and they were joyous. And they opened my eyes that I had absolutely nothing to feel bad about. I had no reason to feel sorry for myself or be pathetic or feel shortchanged or feel like I had been treated unfairly. Those kids that I was working with and loving on me, they would change lives with me. And as pathetic as I felt, they would change their life for mine at the snap of a fingers if they had the chance. Mm-hmm. And it was inspiring for me. And it showed me never, ever close your mind or lose sight of where your inspiration might come from, because it very likely is coming from someplace that you don't expect.
Yeah, that's a good point. Do you regret anything in your life,
Oh my goodness. Tons of regrets, tons of mistakes. I carry a lot of guilt and shame over things I've done, mm-hmm. things I've said, things I didn't say, things I didn't do. Professionally, probably my biggest regret is that there was a point in my life where I put my job and my personal achievement and my personal accomplishments in front of my family. Mm-hmm. I put an enormous amount of battle damage on my wife and kids during that time in my life. And regretfully, it's humiliating to say, it's embarrassing to say to an open audience, I abandoned and betrayed my family for personal reasons, for personal achievement, for personal accomplishment. And I have a lot of guilt over that. Very fortunately for me, I have an amazing family, and I've said this many times, I've made a million mistakes with my life, and my family has given me a million and one second chances.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, it's the people you surround yourself with, sir. You know that. The job, as you know, Jay, it takes a toll on you, and I'm glad that you're able to, because I met your son down in Miami. Your son is an amazing young man, and we were talking about his direction in life, and and it was a joy meeting him. So,
well, you know, I think that those of us in this job, your community hands you a badge and a gun, and they ask you to stand up on their behalf against violence and predators and crime. And we do that, and we do that willingly and enthusiastically. I was always very proud and carried myself with the thought that I was standing up for the good and innocent people in my community against those who intended harm against them. To do that and to do it right and to do it over a long period of time takes massive, like, mental, emotional, physical, spiritual commitment. The people who are great at it don't dabble in it. They go all in. Mm-hmm. And I went all in, and I went overboard at times, to the demise and punishment of my own family. But I also felt like I can't dabble in this. People who dabble in our profession, people who treat it like a hobby, or people who treat it as simply a way to earn a consistent paycheck, that mentality gets people dead, and it gets people around you dead. You have to have that warrior mentality to not only be great at it, but to survive a career in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, like we said, it is important. I try to maintain, like, when I'm at home, and you know this, Jay, when I'm at home, I'm away from work. I'm all in with my family, and I try not to bring work home with me.
That, you know what, and that is a great model, and that is the model that all of us out there, you know, on the job should strive for. I failed miserably at that. I did bring my job home. I did bring that undercover persona home. There was a time where I'd spend weeks and months sometimes on the road and come home. And my wife told me, you can't walk in the door randomly whenever you choose to and then treat us like we are your suspects and talk to us like we're people that you deal with on the street. And then in my self-defense, I told her, I'm not a light switch. I can't turn this on and off. If I turn it off, it's hard to get back on, and I have to be on. Mm-hmm. And then her response was, when you come to this house, you better install a dimmer switch and dial that down, or don't come here until you're done.
Yeah.
And it's shameful that I put my family through that, and I put them in that situation. And I didn't know how else to do it.
Yeah.
I just didn't.
Now, is the Bureau, is the ATF, because they still conduct, obviously, undercover operations, have they gotten better with this, Jay, do you think, because there are other time limits for UC work. I mean, are you only in there for a certain amount of time, or do they keep you in there for the long haul? Do they provide agents now with ways to deal with these conflicts that you were dealing with, or is it just same old business as usual? Has anything changed? Question.
I think there's two theories, and I think they both hold water. You take a lawman who's placed in an undercover assignment. Very typically, those assignments last 2, 3, 4 years, and then that officer is rotated back out to some type of more traditional assignment. And they rotate them out because living a lie and living that street life after 2, 3, 4 years, it's unhealthy. It's mentally and emotionally unhealthy. The argument when those guys rotate out is like, man, I'm just getting good. Mm-hmm. I'm just starting to understand it. I'm just right now, like, really hitting my groove. I can really do great work now. I'm comfortable. But they're forced out for those health reasons. On the other hand, like, that's all I ever did. All I ever did was undercover work, and I got good at it, but it became my undercover role and my persona became more than what I did. It became who I was, because I did it for so long. And that is, man, that's a dangerous, dangerous game to play.
Now, can you talk about, you got a couple books out there, Jay. No Angel and Catching Hell. Can you talk about those books really briefly?
Sure. I wrote No Angel, which was released in 2009, and it is a kind of a memoir slash case study of my infiltration of the Hell's Angels. I wrote a second book, which was released last year, called Catching Hell. And Catching Hell is a bigger picture, more beginning to end career memoir. The back end of that story is pretty brutal. It's harsh. It's a demonstration of what can and sometimes does happen to us as law enforcement professionals over the long haul. And it's neither one of them's a hero story. Neither one of them portray the profession in a very glamorous way. Mm-hmm. But Catching Hell is harsh, man. It's pretty brutal.
Yeah, it's reality.
It is. I wrote as an author. I knew that ultimately my name would be on those books, and I felt like I would be betraying and insulting my profession if I tried to tell or tried to create a hero story, because I never viewed myself as very heroic. I always viewed myself as a common man who had been placed in uncommon situations and just simply did the best he could given the environment or the circumstance. And so I tried to write that way. They're not hero stories. They're brutal, rough, real stories. But if I was going to sign my name to it, I wanted it to be true, and I wanted it to be accurate, and I wanted it to be authentic.
Now, what's next for Jay Dobbins? More books, or what's next in your future, sir?
You know, writing for me does not come easy. I think some people write and it flows, and their ideas and their thoughts and their organization and their structure just is very natural for them. Like, it's not that way for me. I fight it. I fight really hard as a writer. So it's super hard work. I do some public speaking. I speak to law enforcement groups. I speak to corporate audiences at times. I coach high school football. Mm-hmm. Which I love, and to be quite honest, I love being around the kids and having an influence and an impact on those kids probably more than I love the game. I think there's much better football strategists and football tacticians out there than I am. I just love being around the kids, and I love trying to have an impact on where they're going with their life. I have some loose involvement in the entertainment industry. I've consulted on some films and television shows and written some scripts, and I enjoy that. And so it's a hodgepodge, mishmash of when you ask, what are you doing now? Where are you going? Mm-hmm. And you know what? Ask me in 10 minutes, and maybe I'll have an answer for you. Right now, I don't know.
Well, I know you were talking about when you were consulting again down in Miami at the Conclave. You were talking about Hollywood, and Jared Butler is making a. Did that movie come out yet, Jay?
He did. I worked with Gerard Butler and a bunch of actors on a film called Den of Thieves, which was released last January, and I helped. Try to bring authenticity to those undercover characters and to, you know, the way they interacted with each other and walked and talked and the way they carried themselves. And really, as a consultant to the entertainment industry, I'm not there to dictate stories. I'm not there to tell directors or actors or producers how to make movies. I am there to give them a baseline in undercover work and police work and street policing, and then let them decide how does that fit into the story we're trying to tell. when they start skewing outside the lines, it's my job to step up and say, man, you know what? There's a better way to do this. There's a better way to say that. This doesn't sound right, man. It doesn't smell right.
Too Hollywood.
This is not going to fly when the cop community sees this film. If you do that, that's not going to fly. Yeah. It's going to be hokey. Dial it in this direction. Dial it back. Let's say this or do this, trying to keep it authentic. And then, you know, like in my Den of Thieves experience, the director was very open to that. And authenticity was super important to him.
Well, he should be. You're the expert. He should be coming to you.
Well, I think all of us, I think in the profession, and I think it goes for doctors and lawyers and anybody out there that they make movies about our profession, we sit back and we look at it and shake our heads at times, saying like, man, we don't say that. We don't do that. That's not real.
And you had a
and my job is to try to give them that baseline and then let them make the decision whether they want to follow it or they want to skew off of it and go, you know, be creative with their character or with their story.
And you had a little cameo in Den of Thieves.
I do. It's if you sneeze or if you reach into your bucket of popcorn and take your eyes off the screen for a brief moment, you might miss it. But, yeah, I'm there.
Well, Jay Dobbins, sir, it was an honor meeting you down in Miami, and much success to you, sir, in the future.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and much love and respect and admiration out there to your audience. The men and women out there who are listening to this are the ones that make sacrifices to keep me and my family and my community safe, you know, all over the country. And so I don't have the vocabulary. I'm not really smart enough to convey how appreciative I am of that. But just believe from my heart that I admire who you are and what you do.
Thank you, sir. And if people wanted to reach out to you, sir, how can they find you?
Yeah, I'm easy to find. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I have a Twitter account. I have a web page, which is very simple. It's just jaydobbins.com.
Well, sir, thank you for stopping by, and a pleasure meeting you. And, again, much success to you in the future, sir.
Thank you very much. Right. Have a great, amazing new year.
All right, you too, sir.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.